sale now and available at AXS.com. Mississippi Delta was shining like a
national guitar. Yo, this is Immortal Technique. Right now you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles. Revolutionary commentary. You know what it is. KPFK bringing you the realness. Peace.
Harlem streets stay flooded in white powder.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall. Here at the Lawyers Guild Show, we are just waiting. Jim is having some technical issues, as we all do in the 21st century. So he is hopefully going to be receiving a call from KPFK, and he will join us shortly. And in the meantime, I will just go ahead and jump in and tell you what we've got on our plate for today. It's going to be another great show. In our first half hour, constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde will discuss the global threats to freedom of expression as peace activists and others critical of the Israeli government continue to be vilified and falsely labeled as anti-Semitic. Then, in our second half hour, we'll speak with legal scholar Marjorie Cohn about the right wing's effort to erode checks and balances within the United States government, and how Trump and his allies are poised for him to seize and consolidate his power as president. And in the meantime, just wanted to remind you, it is KPFK's winter fun drive time. So please do give. We know that by listening, you are part of our community. You relish free speech, freedom of expression, independent thought. We value your support. So let's see if we can get Jim on the line. D'Angelo, any luck with that? If not, we'll just keep going. I did put his number in the chat. All right, so I will just go ahead and jump right in then as we wait for Jim. Okay, let's get it going. Over more than a year now, Israel, with the strong support of the United States, has been waging war against Hamas and the people of Palestine. The official UN Palestinian death toll is now at least 40,000, with a disproportionately high number of women and children having been killed. Lancet, the highly respected British medical journal, claims a much more reasonable calculation is at least 158,000 have already been killed. Others claim that if the war were to end today, and it most assuredly has not, when bodies and remains from the unimaginable amounts of rubble in Palestine are retrieved and counted, the figure could well exceed 300,000. The Israeli-U.S.-Hamas war has inspired massive protests the world over, including here in the United States, as well as legal actions before the International Criminal Court, findings and resolutions from such international human rights organizations as Amnesty International, as well as countless numbers of resolutions by various governmental entities, including our City Council of Los Angeles. They address the issue of whether Israel is engaged in genocide against the Palestinian people, to what demands and speeches and writings by critics of what Israel and the U.S. are doing in Palestine constitute anti-Semitic demands, speeches, and writings. What is clear is that a great many institutions in this country, including the Congress, as well as local governmental agencies, along with a great number of college and university administrations, have labeled certain demands and speeches critical of Israel's conduct in the war to be quote-unquote anti-Semitic, including claiming that certain demands or speeches condemning Israel's Zionism or calling for a single Israel-Palestinian nation or claiming Israel is committing genocide in Palestine are anti-Semitic. So our topic today is, are certain demands of the anti-Israeli protesters and writings and speeches by critics of Israel, which is an 85% Jewish state, examples of anti-Semitism, and not simply fair political criticism of Israel's actions in the ongoing war? Well, to help us answer these questions and others, I think we do have Jim on the line. Jim,
yep,
are you here?
I'm all set. How you doing?
Great, great. Well, why don't you go ahead and introduce our friend, Stephen Rohde.
Yes, that is my pleasure to do that. Yeah. Well, as I say, and as I think Maria was about to say, to help us answer those and some other questions as well, we do feel, privileged and happy to have with us today our go-to constitutional expert on free speech and related matters. He is Steve Rohde. Mr. Rohde was a longtime practicing attorney. He was then and still is also a political activist, a lecturer, a writer of books on the Constitution. He is the past president of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, the current president of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, or ICUJP as it's frequently called, which formed in the wake of 9/11 for the purpose of organizing faith-based communities to call for an end to war and violence. Mr. Rohde is also past chair of California's Death Penalty Focus Committee and of the group Bend the Ark, a Jewish Partnership for Justice. And Steve Rohde is himself also Jewish. What he's speaking today only on his own behalf, I know, and not on behalf of any of those organizations. But Steve Rohde, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim. It is such a pleasure to be with you and Maria once again.
Well, we do appreciate it, Steve. Let me get started. Steve, since our time is a little bit restricted today, we're in a little bit of fun pitch. We spent a few minutes with that. Why do you contend that the dangers of conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism were, and I quote, on full display this past October when the UCLA Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism and Anti-Israeli Bias released its report entitled Anti-Semitism and Anti-Bias at UCLA. This was a report inspired by the pro-Palestinian encampment there this past spring. An encampment resulting in the bringing of criminal charges and disciplinary charges against some of the students and the pro-Palestinian protesters, but not, I should mention, against the largely Jewish folks from off-campus who came to the campus to violently shut down that peaceful demonstration. So talk to us a bit about that and why you find that report so flawed and so perhaps emblematic of what's going on today around charges of anti-Semitism and conducted in connection with this movement.
Yes, well, school's back in session. Students are returning to campus. They've been there for several months already, and protests are already emerging around the country. The United States, and frankly, the world, is in the grip of a serious free speech issue. Because criticism of Israel is being conflated and demonized as anti-Semitism. When Benjamin Netanyahu was recently the subject of arrest warrants for war crimes and crimes against humanity issued by the International Criminal Court, he chose to accuse the judges of that honorable court of
Excuse me, Bonnie?
Sounds like maybe Steve is having some technical issues. Jim, are you there?
I'm here, of course. I always marvel
at
all these great advances, supposedly, in
there's
technology.
There's Steve. Yeah, Steve is back.
Good. I don't hear you, Steve.
Hi, I'm still here, if you are.
There you go. There you go. That'll teach you to move up north.
So you heard most of my introductory comments, Maria?
About half
yes.
of them, I'd say, Steve.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of the oldest tricks in the book to accuse someone of a hated epithet and in this case, anti-Semitism. But Israel's actions deserve to be subjected to a thorough scrutiny and debate and protest like any other country in the world. Now, we thought we had some hope when UCLA promised to investigate what went on their campus. Unfortunately, we didn't get that. They named their committee the UCLA Task Force to Combat Anti-Semitism and Anti-Israeli Bias. And that was the same as the name of their report. So right there, they conflated anti-Semitism with anti-Israeli bias. Criticism of Israel is not bias. Now, the report violated the cardinal rule of social science research, which is define your terms. And instead, the report brags that in our survey, we intentionally did not provide definitions of anti-Semitism or biased against Israel. And what this did is it...
Oh, dear me, friends.
Yeah, I think it will help if he can cut his camera off. Hey, listeners, sorry about that. We'll use this opportunity to pitch.
Yeah.
Right, Jim? It is KPFK's fundraiser.
Give us a call. You know, we don't do this stuff, but for a few minutes every show, we need your support. Ah, Steve, you're back with us.
Gee, I apologize for the instability of my signal.
No, unless you're the guy who wired it up, I can't blame you.
You can turn off your camera. That helps.
But you were at the point where you made the point that when you equate criticism of Israel with bias, it sort of answers the question they were supposed to honestly study, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And then I made the point that the report itself refused to define the terms. They sent out a survey to 480 students, teachers, and others in the community, and they didn't define anti-Semitism. And what it brought in were all kinds of subjective understandings, which included criticism of Israel as if it was anti-Semitism. So this is a very serious problem, and I'm glad we're discussing it today.
All right.
Well, Steve, I wanted to talk about some of the slogans that we've seen at anti-Israeli protests around the world over what Israel, with the help of the Biden administration, has done and continues to do in Gaza and elsewhere. For example, criticizing Israel as a quote-unquote Zionist nation, or what South African Bishop Tutu around 40 or so years ago referenced when he labeled Israel, like South Africa, an apartheid state. So is criticism of Zionism by nature anti-Semitic?
No, it's not. And I wanted to include from that UCLA report that some students were complaining that death to Israel, Israel equals Nazis, Israel's our native to hell, you are terrorism. These were criticisms of Israel as a nation. And instead, students took those to be anti-Semitism. I think the problem is a loss of history, a loss of understanding the history of Zionism. You know, the founders of Israel willingly took on a known risk when they established a Jewish state. There was a huge, robust debate going back to the 19th century over Zionism. Zionism is a political theory of the establishment of a religious state. It is as subject to criticism and debate as any other concept, such as capitalism or communism or socialism. And there was a robust debate that went on over Zionism back in those days. Many of those were Jews who were anti-Zionist or non-Zionist, as it was also called. anti-Zionists openly opposed a, quote, Jewish sovereign political entity. Non-Zionists did see Palestine as a safe haven for Jews during the Holocaust, but they opposed a Jewish state building because they feared it would destroy the native Arab and Palestinian communities, and it violated the separation of church and state.
You know, and in fact, when they were creating the Jewish state, there were any number of highly religious groups of Jews who opposed the establishment of Israel, where it was being established as the Zionist nation. And when they went around trying to find who would be president of this new Jewish nation, they approached people like Albert Einstein, a Jewish gentleman, who said, I wouldn't be a part of such a discriminatory state. Zionism
yes,
is discriminatory.
Are opposed. So if I'm losing my signal, I'll push forward to the next question from you.
Let's get on with another couple of the chants and the things we hear that have been called anti-Semitic. At demonstrations, anti-Israel protests often will chant, Netanyahu, Netanyahu, you can't hide, we charge you with genocide. Is it anti-Semitic to accuse Israel, or any country for that matter, of committing genocide in the course of its waging of war?
It's not. And the proof of that is that the International Court of Justice, which is the judicial arm of the UN, earlier this year found a plausible case of genocide. Amnesty International, only weeks ago, issued a comprehensive examination of what Israel is doing in Gaza and the West Bank, and found genocide was the appropriate accusation. And we've just heard that Netanyahu and his colleague have been charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. You cannot banish from the world debate over Israel's war in Gaza the accusation of genocide or any other accusation in the midst of a political international debate. And to do it by labeling it anti-Semitism is simply an effort to silence that debate and to especially silence the pro-Palestinian side of that debate.
And Steve, well, speaking of chants, what about the pro-Palestinian chant, quote, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free? Can't that chant be interpreted as wanting to see the elimination of Israel and all of the territory returned to the Palestinians?
Some people have interpreted it that way. There's been a lot of study that by scholars and human rights and Palestinian advocates, including Jewish groups, which call the chant a call for the right to self-determination by the Palestinians. And even the debate over the nature of a one-state solution, a two-state solution, or whether Israel has lost its way in the Middle East, all of that is open to debate. None of that should lead to professors being fired and students being disciplined and student organizations being canceled. That is what has become so corrosive about this entire debate.
Indeed, it has. And indeed, I want to be clear, and I know all of us want to be clear, that we're not suggesting that there's an anti-Semitism in this world. Sadly, there's all too much of it. I don't even argue that it may have grown as a result of what Israel's done, but that's a separate topic. But we're talking here about whether or not certain criticisms of Israel, voiced by the pro-Palestinian movement, are anti-Semitic, because anti-Semitism has been used to close down those debates and what have you. Indeed, at New York University now, they've created a new protected class, quote-unquote, and that are Zionists. So if you protest against Zionism, you've violated the rights of a student on campus, and you can be disciplined for that and so on. So it's gotten very harsh. But anyway, Steve, let's talk a bit about the report from Irene Kahn, the UN's special rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. She entitled her report, Global Threats to Freedom of Opinion and Expressing Arising from the Conflict in Gaza, Contrast that, if you would, with the report you were discussing earlier from UCLA.
This report by Irene Kahn, issued in August, has simply not received the attention it deserves. This is a permanent position the UN established as a special rapporteur on the promotion and protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. She issued an extensive report. I urge anyone to simply Google that report and go to it. She overall documented, quote, a pattern of killings and arbitrary detention of journalists and destruction of press facilities and equipment in Gaza, demonstrating, quote, a deliberate strategy of the Israeli military to silence critical reporting and obstruct documentation of possible international crimes, unquote. Now, for our present purposes, even though the report covers a lot more, one of the most clear and cogent aspects of her report was the criticism that she found that there has been a tendency, and these are her words, to confuse and conflate criticism of the policies of Israel, which is a legitimate exercise of freedom of expression, with anti-Semitism, which is racial and religious hatred against Jews that must be condemned. She documents how this has taken place. Now, she's very clear, as you just said, that, quote, anti-Semitism is a serious form of religious and racial hatred, and states, meaning governments and private actors, must take all necessary steps to fight it. But, she emphasized, that it is vital that the fight against anti-Semitism be framed according to international human rights standards, so that there is a shared understanding of the problem and its root causes, and consequently more effective responses to eradicate it. Otherwise, she points out, there is a risk of discrimination against one vulnerable group will be replaced with the discrimination against another group, which, far from reducing anti-Semitism, will fuel more hatred and intolerance. She's very clear that these charges put at risk Jews across the world, because to conflate these is to inflame the criticism of Israel as being a form of anti-Semitism. It dilutes the true examples of anti-Semitism we do see around the world. So it not only is bad for the sake of freedom of expression and open debate, it actually undermines Jewish safety across the world.
Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Maria Hall here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. This is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. We're here with Stephen Rohde. And just a reminder, it's fund drive time, so please go to kpfk.org and give what you can. Steve Rohde, Kahn's report expresses serious concern, which you mentioned, about the current quote-unquote working definition of anti-Semitism drafted by the International Holocaust Alliance, which was referenced in the UCLA report and now adopted by the U.S. Department of State and the City of Los Angeles. She's not alone, is she, in having these serious concerns about the definition? Talk to us about the issue and its impact on the political debate over Israel's actions in its current war against the Palestinians.
Yes, I think it's very important for listeners to be aware of this working definition, because it's being cited by pro-Israel sources. It's being cited at university campuses and in Congress and elsewhere to suppress free speech on these issues. So the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance a few years ago came out with a working definition of anti-Semitism. Parts of it were a traditional definition that all of us would accept. The problem is that it went on to use examples of anti-Semitism, which collapsed into the definition criticism of Israel. It gave examples of criticizing Israel, of calling out genocide and other issues. So the very report from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance fed the phenomenon we're talking about today. Unfortunately, that definition, known as the IHRA working definition, has been adopted by the U.S. Department of State, by the city of Los Angeles, by 47 states. The definition itself from that organization said it should not be used in any regulations of speech or in any official capacity. A former special rapporteur called the working definition divisive and politically instrumentalized. Irene Kahn said it's overbroad and vague. It uses illustrative examples which impact Israel rather than individuals who are subjected to anti-Semitism. And it's in that section of the report that Irene Kahn also pointed out that Zionism is a political ideology, that the practical consequences of collapsing anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism is the suppression of legitimate criticism of Israel. Those are the words of the UN rapporteur. And that Jewish groups and individuals who engage in anti-Zionist protests have been labeled anti-Semites. She pointed out that, for example, that pro-Palestinian groups have been protected on university campuses, while pro-Palestinian groups have not. And in a very simple statement, she said, Zionism is not an inherent characteristic of an individual or group, which would render it a protected class. It is simply one political ideology among many, and it is vulnerable and should be subjected to searching political analysis and criticism.
You know, it's also, I'm listening to it, and you're so right, Steve, but I'm listening, most of these demonstrations, certainly the larger ones, certainly I would argue that the main and most the strongest and most consistent groups organizing pro-Palestinians, anti-Israeli demonstrations around the war in Gaza are groups like Jewish Voice for Peace. I mean, and this notion that every time there's a dispute within the Jewish community that those that don't take the pro-Israeli position are somehow self-hating Jews is insulting intellectually and bogus, and really shows the weakness, I think, of those who try to defend Israel's position. So, but last thoughts, Steve, before we do run out of time, last thoughts on how our listeners can follow your writings and such.
Well, I'm proud to publish at L.A. Review of Books, at L.A. Progressive, Truth Dig, and elsewhere. And a simple search at any of those groups, publications, will unearth my material, Steve Rohde, R-O-H-D-E. I am dedicated to exercising my own freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I have a full dress article coming out in those publications on these issues. And I, for one, as well as the two of you, am dedicated to continuing to make this struggle clear to the American people and to be sure that no voice is silenced in the midst of this debate.
Yeah, and we're only looking at a tougher next 4 years, I think, in terms of what we can say, what we can do, how we can organize on the streets without governmental influence, at least in some places of the country, hopefully not here in L.A. And therefore, I think it behooves us all the more to be understanding, tolerant, and honest when we criticize those who are in the streets. There are any number of demonstrations that take place. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I don't accuse them of being stooges or anti-American. I can remember during the Vietnam War, when we first started our protests there, we were anti-American. Why? Because we were opposed to U.S. going and intervening in somebody else's civil war and costing the lives of them. Americans and so forth. That changed once support for the war, of course, was ending. Well, Steve Rohde, thank you once again, as always. I'm sorry you had some technical difficulties, but nevertheless, you managed to get across your points brilliantly, as always, and we thank you for being here with us on the Lawyers Guild show again.
Thank you, Jim and Maria.
All right, I guess we'll now take a brief station break. Friends, don't go anywhere. Listeners, stay right with us. I do mean brief. We'll be back with you with another very fascinating aspect of the Trump administration that I don't know that you've heard much about yet. So stay with us.
Supporters include Golden Voice, presenting Alison Krauss and Union Station, featuring Jerry Douglas, Sunday, July 13th at the Greek Theater. Tickets on sale now and available at AXS.com.
Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Well, my friends and listeners, we are back with you as promised after that station ID. Before we introduce our next guest, let us just take a minute or so to remind you, we weren't able to do virtually any of it in the first half hour because we had some technical difficulties with our guest, Steve Rohde. And we don't spend a lot of time in each show now doing it, but fair is fair. We bring you this kind of programming, not just on the Lawyers Guild show, but all over the place. Maria Hall and I, each week, all the staff here, except for one or two people who are volunteers, our paid staff would tell you they're volunteers because goodness knows they don't earn what they could get at some other station, but they believe in this station. The progressive movements of L.A. believe in this station. That's why we have so many of them on our show. We give them a chance they don't get on the mainstream corporate media to talk about their protests, talk about their politics. And they understand we're part of the progressive movement, and that, therefore, as I say each week when we do this, when you contribute to KPFK, you contribute to the progressive cause in Los Angeles. I shudder to think where those people would find voice were it not for this station. So please, you go to our website, as Maria has suggested, kpfk.org. Lots of ways we say thank you when you contribute at different levels, $50, $60. Get some T-shirts or cups or what have you. Well, Maria, you're so much better at this than I am. What are some of the ways we say thank you when they contribute?
Oh, yeah, there's always a great curated selection of premiums, thank you gifts. We know the real reason you want to give, of course, is to be part of the community, but there are some fun items if you want to check those out at kpfk.org. And yeah, I mean, you know what happens when the powers that be try to silence us. We really only have one course of action, which is to turn up the volume and speak even louder. So if you're able to, please turn up the volume on your support of KPFK and make a donation to the winter fund drive. You can go, like we said, kpfk.org. It's easy. It's fun. It will make you feel good. And it's really up to us to protect independent media.
Yes, we are one of five stations that are affiliated with Pacifica Broadcasting Network. And in case you missed it in that 900-page report, the Project 2025, which we heard so much about during the campaign, not only talks about the media in general and why it's got to become more Trump-friendly, specifically mentions Pacific Radio, that is to say us, my friends, as something that should be gotten rid of because of the damage we do to what they want to do under Project 2025. So with that in mind, I would hope you'd be inclined and inspired to pick up your phones. Give us a call at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or go to the website, as we suggest. Contribute all you can. If you got a good job these days, contribute two or three times more than you might have been otherwise. We know people are listening who have no job. Keep listening, my friends. We're sorry you don't owe us anything. We're just glad you're part of the KPFK family. Well, Maria, introduce our next special guest. And let's complete our show.
Yes, that was a good segue. Speaking of Project 2025, yeah. Unfortunately. Well, you know, if you grew up in the United States, you probably learned that the United States government is comprised of three branches, and they are supposed to protect us, the people, on any one of those three branches from accumulating too much power. You know, that's the legislative, judicial, and executive branches. Well, today we're focusing on the powers of the executive branch, that is the president's advisors, and various departments and agencies within the government. Just how much power does or can an individual US president have? What checks and balances exist to limit that power? And the big question is, how will it all play out as Donald Trump and his allies take the White House once again? To help us answer these questions, we're so fortunate to have as our guest Professor Marjorie Cohen. Professor Cohen is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, advisory board member of Veterans for Peace, and founding dean of the People's Academy of International Law. Professor Cohen's books include Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. And we were especially intrigued by her latest article in Truthout, titled, Trump is Using a Unitary Executive Theory in His Bid to Amass Supreme Power. Wow, that is an intriguing title, and we're going to break it all down for you, though. Marjorie Cohen, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks for having me, Maria and Jim.
Yes, our pleasure. So before we talk about this unitary executive theory, which I learned about in your article, start us off with some basics. Who exactly falls under the executive branch in the government? I know most people know it's the president, but what other departments and agencies are included?
Well, of course, there's the president and the vice president and the cabinet. But in terms of the departments, there are 15 of them, the departments of agriculture, commerce, defense, education, energy, health and human services, homeland security, housing and urban development, the interior, justice, labor, state, transportation, treasury, and veterans affairs. And then we have the agencies, which include, among others, the Federal Communications Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and on and on and on.
So
Well, my
basically,
goodness.
all aspects of our life.
I wonder, Marjorie, have the legislature, the Congress, and the judiciary imposed in the past checks and balances on the executive branch? What are some of those checks and balances, for example? And do you expect the current Supreme Court, given its very rightward bent, and the current legislature, which is Republican, do you think it's going to rise to the challenge of preventing Trump and his administration from amassing too much power?
Well, first of all, in terms of checks and balances and the three supposedly co-equal branches of government, you have the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branch. Congress, the legislative branch, makes the laws. The judicial branch, the courts, interpret the laws and determine whether they are constitutional. And the executive takes care that the laws be enforced. It's called the Take Care Clause of the Constitution. They have more or less checked and balanced the other two branches of government, the Congress and the courts, checked and balanced the executive branch in the past. During the so-called War on Terror, the Supreme Court issued a number of decisions telling George W. Bush he couldn't torture and get away with it. He couldn't locate prisoners at Guantanamo, which is on Cuban soil, and say, oh, the Constitution doesn't apply. There are threats to the checks and balances. I'll just give you a few examples. Donald Trump is going to, or if he can be believed, weaponize the Department of Justice for political purposes, end the independence of independent agencies, replace expert civil servants with political loyalists, circumvent Congress's power to decide how to spend federal funds, weaken the independent media and news reporting, as Jim just mentioned, misuse the Insurrection Act against Americans to stifle dissent, and neutralize the Senate's role in confirming executive branch nominees by misusing the recess appointments. In terms of the legislature checking and balancing the president, as everyone knows, the Republican Party doesn't just have the executive branch in the person of Donald Trump, but also the two houses of Congress will have a Republican majority, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And that means that they basically control the agenda. They control what the committees do because they have the committee chairmanships, chairpersonships. They determine the agendas of those committees. And in terms of the Supreme Court, I would not hold my breath on the Supreme Court checking and balancing the executive. There are six reactionary members of the Supreme Court, a supermajority, three of whom were appointed by Donald Trump. And in their recent decision on immunity, they said that the president is absolutely immune from criminal liability for core official actions and presumptively immune from criminal liability for other official actions. So I do not have a lot of faith and hope that the other two branches of government are going to check and balance the executive.
I can well understand that. I'm sorry, Maria. I know you're wanting to ask a question. Please do. I'm just sitting here scratching my head at all this.
It's a lot, you know, living day-to-day history, making history every day. So Marjorie Cohen, I was intrigued by this unitary executive theory that you wrote about, and I don't think it's a new concept, but I had never heard about it. So can you explain to, you know, listeners what exactly unitary executive theory is, where does it come from, and who are its proponents?
Well, the unitary executive theory basically says that the executive branch is unitary. That means the president has complete command and control over it. The unitary executive scheme has its roots in the imperial presidency during the Civil War, and it reached its zenith during the Nixon administration. In 1862, then President Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus without congressional authorization. And President Richard Nixon, who ultimately resigned for his lawbreaking during the Watergate scandal, famously declared, "When the president does it, that means it's not illegal." In 1988, in Morrison versus Olson, Antonin Scalia wrote a solitary dissent favoring the unitary executive, and he maintained that the Article II vesting clause of the Constitution, which says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, does not mean some of the executive power, but all of the executive power. Then, during the George W. Bush administration, John Yoo, that infamous law professor who teaches his courses in undisclosed locations, I wonder why, he's one of the primary authors of the torture memos, and he elevated the unitary executive model to a central tenet of the Bush presidency. He actually said, he told Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, that Congress could not prevent the president from ordering torture. When she asked if any law prohibited the president from crushing the testicles of a child during the interrogation of their parent, John Yoo responded, "I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that." John Yoo obviously is not familiar with the Convention Against Torture or the U.S. torture statute, both of which forbid torture in all instances, including a state of war. Now, John Yoo, who sought to empower the president to override the will of Congress, inserted the phrase unitary executive into George W. Bush's signing statements, which were attached to legislation that he signed. And in those so-called signing statements, Bush reserved the right to disobey any parts of congressional statutes with which he disagreed. Samuel Alito, another member of the Supreme Court, who served in the Reagan administration, supports the unitary executive theory. And at his Supreme Court confirmation hearing in 2006, he said, "The concept of unitary executive doesn't have to do with the scope of executive power. It has to do with who within the executive branch controls the exercise of executive power. And the theory is that the Constitution says executive power is conferred on the president." Now, Bill Barr, who was Trump's attorney general in his first administration, before he was appointed attorney general, and many people think he was actually trying to get Trump's attention with this long memo that Barr wrote criticizing special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Trump. And in that memo, Barr maintained that the president has total control over the executive branch. He wrote, "Constitutionally, it is wrong to conceive of the president as simply the highest officer within the executive branch hierarchy. He alone is the executive branch. As such, he is the sole repository of all executive powers conferred by the Constitution." Other members of the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, favor the unitary executive. Proponents of the unitary executive say that the Constitution's Article 2 establishes a hierarchical, unified executive department under the direct control of the president, who alone possesses all of the executive power and therefore can direct, control, and supervise inferior officers or agencies who seek to exercise discretionary executive power. And Peter Strauss, who is a professor emeritus at Columbia, told the New York Times they are clawing away at agency independence in ways that I find quite unfortunate and disrespectful of congressional choice. The regrettable fact is that the judiciary at the moment seems inclined to recognize that the president does have this unitary executive authority.
Boy, does it ever. As you pointed out, and not only does it ever, but it has it at a time when those who are running the government, all too many of those in the House, all too many of those in the Senate, and certainly Trump is putting together a team around him in the cabinet and elsewhere, to have that kind of attack, that kind of almost unprecedented, would you agree, with the unprecedented use of the unitary executive theory, with a guy like Trump and his coterie with him, I think it represents a real threat to our democracy and to governance as we've known him. But talk to us a bit about that, because as I mentioned earlier, the show Project 2025 is involved. It talks about how those who wrote it talk about how the unitary executive theory will serve and should serve as a blueprint, really, to amass power for the office of the president. So I'm not just whistling Dixie, as they say, when I say that. They've spelled it out pretty clearly, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Project 2025 is a 920-page blueprint or roadmap for an imperial presidency. It's the right-wing roadmap. It's anchored in the unitary executive scheme. A report issued in October by the Center for American Progress said, "This radical governing philosophy, which contravenes the traditional separation of powers, vests presidents with almost complete control over the federal bureaucracy, including congressionally designated independent agencies or the Department of Justice and the FBI. The unitary executive theory is designed to sharply diminish Congress's imperative role to act as a check and balance on the executive branch with tools such as setting up independent agencies to make expert decisions and by limiting presidents' ability to fire career civil servants for purely political purposes. Now, Project 2025 details the way in which Trump would circumvent Congress by taking complete control of all administrative agencies that protect our health, safety, food, water, climate, and labor rights. And in June, the Supreme Court ruled that a federal agency doesn't have the last word on protecting these rights. When a statute is ambiguous, an agency must now defer to the courts, many of which are staffed by judges appointed by Trump, instead of doing what has been done in the past, which is following interpretations of agency experts. And another plan that Project 2025 calls for Trump's second administration is to reinstitute one of his previous executive orders. It's called Schedule F. Joe Biden eliminated it when he came into office, but Schedule F would reclassify 50,000 of the 2 million merit-based civil service employees as political employees who serve at the pleasure of the president with no civil service protections. Very, very frightening.
Well, Marjorie Cohen, we are going to have to sign off shortly, but I definitely wanted to get this question in, and I know it's a challenging one. If you had to choose just one of the many, many issues to amplify to our listeners today, what would it be? In other words, what should we all be particularly on alert for in the coming months?
Well, just one thing briefly, and then I'll get into my favorite. Well, I don't say my favorite. I mean, one of the most disturbing, I should say. And that is that a number of Trump's choices for his cabinet are authors and influencers of Project 2025. Many of them are associated with Project 2025, Office of Management and Budget, Director of the FCC, the Border Czar, the Immigration Hawk, the CIA Director, Ambassador to Canada, etc. But I think one of the most frightening things that we have to look forward to, and this is something that Congress is poised to do, to pass legislation that would give Trump broad authority to punish his political opponents. It's called the Nonprofit Killer Bill, and it would empower the Secretary of the Treasury to designate any nonprofit group as a terrorist-supporting organization and revoke its tax-exempt status, effectively shutting it down with no due process. Now, the House of Representatives have already passed H.R. 9495, the so-called Stop Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act. And this bill will likely be introduced with a different number and passed by the House of Representatives again in the next congressional term after the first of the year. The GOP is going to take control of the Senate. It will likely pass that bill as well. Although it's aimed primarily at organizations that support the Palestinian struggle, the legislation could be used to shutter any group that opposes Trump's policies. This bill is not about terrorism. It's about giving Donald Trump unlimited authority to label his opponents as terrorists, according to Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas on MSNBC. If enacted, this legislation would dovetail with Project 2025's plan to remake the U.S. government in Trump's authoritarian image. And if this comes to pass, Trump will be the unitary executive on steroids.
Yikes. Well, we are sadly out of time because we have to leave a couple of minutes for some business. But before we let you go, where can people, I know, but where can people learn more about your thinking, your writing? Where can they find it?
Well, I write a regular column for Truth Out. It's called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. So if you go to the Truth Out page, just go to the very bottom and you'll see Human Rights and Global Wrongs. And then my articles and videos and radio and books, et cetera, are collected on my own website, marjoriecohen.com.
Yeah, and let me say, and I do this only when I mean it. I never miss, rarely ever miss, one of Marjorie Cohen's writings in Truth Out. You don't have to be a Philadelphia lawyer to understand it. That's what makes it. She has an ability to explain, as she did today, often a very difficult concept, perhaps in a way that's accessible to anyone, really, who could read. And so I encourage you, listeners, if you want to have a quick way of really understanding some of the critical issues, and they're political and legal, that we're going to be facing over these next few years, you could do no better than to check the truth out. And when you see a Marjorie Cohen article, read it, or also go to her website. Well, Marjorie Cohen, thank you for being with us again here on the Lawyers Guild Show. We let you go as I say, do a couple of minutes worth of business.
Thank you so much. Keep up your great work.
Thank you. All right, my friends. And we did want to reserve a couple minutes because we didn't have any time really at all to talk to you about our needs. We talk about the nation's needs. We talk about the workers' needs. We talk about immigrant needs. We talk about all that every week here on the Lawyers Guild Show. And then there are a few times a year when we spend a couple of weeks talking about our own needs. And our own needs are very dire. You can certainly tell that not only has Project 2025 made it clear that the Trump administration wants to shut down Pacifica Radio, shut down KPFK and the other four Pacifica stations in the country, it wants to basically, do away with any kind of liberal or honest or even objective media. It's going after public radio in general. So we need your support. We're not going to get it from the government. We're going to be having to fight this back on our own. With your support, otherwise we don't win. With your support, we win. So 818-985-5735. Give us a call now. There are volunteers waiting to tell you some nice ways we say thank you when you make a donation to us. Or go to the website, kpfk.org, and there's all sorts of ways that you can pick the level in which you want to contribute, and there'll be some opportunities to pick and choose what you'd like to have us send to you. We hope what we send to you 24/7, 7 days a week, is enough, even if we didn't have any thank you gifts, for you to make that kind of donation. Push has come to shove. I'm 86 years old. I can't remember a more dangerous time in America, dangerous to our democracy, dangerous to the world, than now. And therefore, I can't imagine a time when we were needed a station like KPFK and a network like Pacifica than now. So now is when you must give to us, my friends, if we're going to be able to continue and win the fight that lies ahead, which we can win. People power always wins, but it has to unite. It has to support itself. I think you agree with that, Maria, don't you?
Oh, you know I do. And yeah, if you out there, listeners, wherever you are today, you want to be part of doing something tangible, just give a little something back, whether you can afford $5 or $500 or probably something in between. Every dollar counts. And it's really about all of us pitching in a little bit. And that's really what we have. We have the numbers. We may not have billions of dollars, but we have the numbers, and we have an intention to be critical and to hear diverse opinions and to look for the truth.
Yeah, sadly, and we're not like the LA Times. We're not like the Washington Post, which are in some ways good papers, but we weren't afraid of Trump. We're not afraid of telling you what we think. When he's wrong, we say you're wrong. The Congress does something right, we say, hey, that's good. When it does something wrong, we say it. We're not beholden to anyone. We don't take much of any corporate sponsorship. If so, it's not for money-making kind of corporations. We're not like corporate media. That's the other thing that distinguishes us. We're not afraid of Trump. We're worried about him. We're worried about what this next administration is going to be like. And that's why we're trying to speak that truth to power, because we know we're in the fight of our lives, but we're not worried about our own skins, even though we probably should be, except to say we're worried about the entire progressive movement of which we are part. And that's why when you send to us whatever contribution you can, you've really helped progressive movement having a voice in LA, having a radio voice in LA, having a voice that it doesn't otherwise have. So, and we're all together, we make that kind of team that can win the fight, but only if we're all together. That means you making a contribution too. This ain't free. We have to pay the same bills you do for electricity and rent and everything else. Maria, I know you and I often, I'm going to pledge during the drive, of course. I know you always do. I sometimes get some of the great old music that we, some of the great old music we have. And Maria gets, she's collecting every cup that we ever made, right?
Yes, and unfortunately, we're wrapping now, Jim.
Yeah, we're wrapping up. So let me just say thank you for listening today, friends. Do make that call. Do support us. We'll be back with you again next week. On behalf of Jim Lafferty, myself, and Maria Hall, my friend and co-host, you stand up for your rights, my friends. That's what's most important.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.